Hello everyone, it's Mark Godaker here. Welcome to the NT Pod, the podcast all about the New Testament and Christian origins. It's episode 112, and today I'm asking, what is redaction criticism? Now, redaction criticism is a strange term. It sounds kind of scary. It sounds complicated. And New Testament scholars really do like complicated jargon. I sometimes think they like confusing people. And there's a real issue with this term, redaction criticism, because in contemporary English, redaction means to erase or to hide or to blank out bits of text, like usually in a government document which is being released to the public, and there are certain sensitive or confidential things that they don't want people to see. So they talk about the text being redacted. Now, redaction criticism, the word redaction there is related to that. It's the same etymology. But basically what happened with the New Testament is that redaction criticism was born in Germany in the 1950s. And they use the term Redaktionsgeschichte, and that really means something more like editorial history or editorial kind of working things out, telling stories. And it's not just about taking things out, it's about adding things, recrafting, adding, subtracting, reworking, recreating. So it's much more broad in scope than the English word redaction. What happened was that when that term Redaktionsgeschichte was translated into English, the translators used the term redaction criticism because the redaction bit sounded similar to redaction in German. And so it stuck, and we're stuck with this term. And I have sometimes toyed with the idea of dropping it altogether because it is misleading. But it is so often used in the literature that I decided that we may as well go with it. But I said that it began in Germany in the 1950s. And that's certainly the case. There was, before it emerged, there'd been much more stress in the work of form critics, form criticism, Formsgeschichte. There was much more stress on the pre-gospel stage, the oral tradition, trying to look at the individual forms of particular passages and then extrapolate from there to work out what the early Christian preaching was like. So this is the heyday of Rudolf Bultmann and Martin Debelius. They wanted to try and get to the pre-gospel preaching. Now, it has to be said that a lot of the work of early redaction criticism can be a little bit dry. I remember reading through Hans Conselmann's Theology of St. Luke when I was on holiday as a teenager. And I was a bit of a precocious teenager, right? That was the kind of stuff that I read. And I remember ploughing through a great big discussion called Geographical Elements, where Conselmann tries to illustrate how Luke has recrafted his geography to suit his own interests. And the book itself has got a really boring title. I mean, Theology of St. Luke, really? I mean, that wasn't Conselmann's fault. In German, it was called Die Mitte der Zeit, the middle of time. The thesis being that Luke hasn't just changed geography, he's changed time. Instead of focusing on the end times, like Matthew and Mark, Luke puts Jesus in the middle of time. He's no longer at the eschaton, at the end of time. He's in the middle of time. And Conselmann thought that Luke had recrafted his source material to reflect that essential way of thinking. I mean, it is quite a tedious book. If he submitted it these days for a doctoral degree, I don't think he would pass, because one of the things that we like in doctoral dissertations, we like signposts and summaries and conclusions, show the reader where they are. And Conselmann doesn't do that. I mean, I often think of Alice thinking about her sister's book, that it had no pictures or conversation. A lot of New Testament books have no charts or synopses or signposts or summaries or conclusions. And Conselmann's like that. One of my teachers, John Ashton, used to say that you only know that there's no more. You only know that Conselmann's book has finished because there's no more of it, which I always thought was quite funny. But in the end, Conselmann, like Willy Marxen and Gunther Bornkamm, they were quite influential. they basically changed the way that New Testament scholars thought about the way that the Gospels were constructed. And you get much more focus in the latter half of the 20th century, right into the present, on the authors themselves, the evangelists themselves that they characterize as these redactors. So what is redaction criticism basically all about? Really what it is, it's looking at the evangelist as editors, looking at them as authors, looking at how they crafted their source material in ways that affected their theological, literary, and other interests. And it's pretty intuitive once you start looking at the Gospels side by side. You look at how Luke edits Mark, how Matthew edits Mark, how I would say also how Luke edits Matthew. Let me just give a quick example. It's always easier to illustrate something than it is to explain it. Luke 3:22, Jesus is getting baptized in Luke's gospel. And before the dove descends on Jesus, only in Luke we get the line that Jesus was praying. So you go, Jesus is praying in Luke. That's a difference. And then you ask the question, does Luke add prayer elsewhere? Is this a Lucan motif? Is this a redactional interest? And yes, it is. Before Jesus calls the 12 in Luke 6, Jesus is praying. Before Peter's confession in Luke chapter 9, Jesus is praying. Before giving the Lord's Prayer in chapter 11, Jesus is praying. And even on the cross, Jesus prays, Father, forgive them, and into your hands I commit my spirit. So you rightly conclude that Luke places emphasis on prayer. It's not that the others don't, the others have prayer, but it's just that in Luke, this is a special focus, something he enhances from his source material. If you were looking at Matthew's gospel, you'd notice the way that he frequently adds the idea of the scriptures being fulfilled right from chapter one all the way through to the end of the gospel. Matthew keeps having phrases like, this happened in order to fulfill. So you conclude that Matthew must be really interested in the fulfillment of scripture. So you see how straightforward it is? That's really what redaction criticism is. You might ask, though, what's the point of this? Is it just like making lists of characteristic material in the Gospels? Is it just about getting to know what makes Luke Luke and what makes Matthew Matthew? Well, it becomes interesting because of what it actually reveals about the authors. You actually get to feel that you know them as creative writers, and then you can reflect on why they're doing what they're doing. So I've mentioned already the question of eschatology. Luke has a much more realized eschatology than Mark or Matthew. And you can tease that out through redaction criticism in subtle ways. Whereas in Mark, you've got some of those standing here will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God come with power. In Luke, he drops the with power. It's always less of a dramatic event in Luke. It's something which can even be potentially grasped now. So when you look at these subtle changes that Luke makes to his source material, you're able to extrapolate from that to working out what his particular theology is. Now, of course, in some ways, this is just source criticism with a fancy name. And although the original redaction critics relied on the two-source theory, I think it's fair to say that it works just as well with the Farrar theory, which is the theory that I uphold. And I would actually say it works better on the Farrar theory. I mean, for example, when you look at the way that Luke redacts Mark, you often find that he does the same things when he's redacting Matthew. So to me, it provides a kind of confirmation of the Farrar theory, but of course, those that believe in Q would say something opposite to that. Now, if we're focusing on Matthew's changes to Mark, Luke's changes to Mark, Luke's changes to Matthew, that does, of course, raise the question, what about Mark? We can't see his sources. If Mark is the first gospel, we can't see his sources. So how can we do redaction criticism with Mark? Well, you can still do it. What you do is you look for repeated emphases. You look for things like the secrecy theme in Mark's gospel. In Mark's gospel, you keep getting Jesus telling people not to tell that he's the Son of God or what he's done. He shuts up the demons who seem to know who he is, and he doesn't want Peter to tell people that Jesus is the Christ. So those themes that run through Mark, those repeated themes, you say, aha, well, that's a bit of mark and redaction. Or you look at pivotal moments, like really key structuring moments, like Peter's confession, which comes kind of in the middle of Mark's gospel. Or you look for overarching theological themes that you see in Mark, like the way of the Lord. Joel Marcus has made the case that you can read Mark's gospel as a gospel about Jesus on the way of the Lord. I'm actually a big fan of reduction criticism. I love doing reduction criticism. I think it must be 3 or 4 dictionary articles and encyclopedia articles I've written on it. It's the kind of thing people ask me to write about. But having said I'm a fan, I do think it's important to say that there are things wrong with reduction criticism, and not just the name. There are things wrong with the practice. I think one of the biggest problems is that reduction critics tend to assume that an author is most themselves when they're changing stuff, when they're adding stuff. And of course, there's some truth in that. But when I'm writing, I sometimes see something in a source that I think is so good that I say to myself, I couldn't say it better myself. And when I say that, I quote that author. When I write, I often go to someone like Austin Farrer or Michael Golder or Morton Scott Enslin, one of my favorite scholars, and just quote them because they say it better than I can say it. What if Matthew thought that way with Mark sometimes, so that he's not just copying Mark in a docile way and that doesn't represent what Matthew thinks? He is copying Mark when he thinks that Mark is all that, when he's just so. So that has to be borne in mind, that sometimes it's what the evangelists retain from their sources that is exciting and distinctive of their thinking. I think there's also a danger in redaction criticism that you can overinterpret redactional changes. A change can just be sometimes like a simple stylistic tweak, and it might say nothing at all about the author. I mean, let me illustrate what I mean. A lot of redaction criticisms like to talk about gospel communities, the idea that you can read from the changes that Matthew makes to Mark something about the history of the Matthean community. And in New Testament scholarship, you've got histories of the Matthean community, histories of the Markan community, the Lucan community, the Johannan community, the Q community. It doesn't stop. These communities are seen everywhere, and we have no actual external evidence for them. They're read out of the redactional quirks of the particular evangelists, and it can be a dangerous procedure. Let me illustrate what I mean. A lot of people think that in Matthew's gospel, we see evidence that there's a Matthean community that has separated itself from the local Jewish synagogue. So this is a Christian Jewish community that is hostile to the non-Christian Jewish synagogue, perhaps over the road or in the next village or whatever. And one of the pieces of evidence that people use for this is that Matthew uses this phrase, their synagogue and their synagogues, as if to contrast with our synagogues. And he talks this all about their scribes, as if we have scribes. So lots of people say, aha, we can see evidence of the Matthean community because he's characterizing these others as something alien, as something different. And I'm just not sure that that kind of thing works. Let me give an example as to why. In Matthew 13:54, we have the story of the rejection at Nazareth. Matthew seems to have taken this over from Mark 6. It's very close between Matthew and Mark. And in Matthew 13:54, you get the line, he came to his hometown and he began to teach the people in their synagogue. So lots of New Testament scholars say their synagogue, different from our synagogue, the Matthean community synagogue. But that's just an overreading, in my opinion, because the sentence makes perfect sense in its context. Listen to it again. He came to his hometown and began to teach the people in their synagogue. The there in the synagogue is the people from that town. There has a perfectly good antecedent. It's the people in Jesus's hometown. Okay, so I said I like summaries, and I'm not just going to stop this podcast in the way that Conzelman's book just stops. What's the takeaway? 2 things. First is, don't be afraid of redaction criticism. It's great fun. It's something that you can practice the moment that you open up the text of the Gospels. You'll see differences, you'll see unique features, pivotal elements, and then you can extrapolate from that to theories about what the author might be doing. But also I would say, second point, don't overreach. You might think you found details of a Methean community, only to see it vanish away as you take a closer look at the text. Well, thanks so much for listening to this latest episode of the NT Pod. It's always a pleasure to have your company. You can find me on the web at podacre.blogspot.com, and this podcast is available on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, and other places. You can also find it on YouTube, where it has pictures. Pop along there and subscribe to the channel. Thanks again so much for listening. I hope to be along again soon. Bye-bye.